York, this is Democracy Now!
I do pray that you show me mercy and that you give me a second chance. That is my prayer. And I can assure each and every one of you that if you do, like, I won't disappoint you. I'm not going to let you down.
Meet Cyntoia Brown Long. She was forced into sexual slavery as a child and sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder for shooting her rapist as a teenager. The shooting happened when Cyntoia was just 16 years old, but she was tried as an adult. After years of protests, Cyntoia Brown was granted clemency by former Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam. She was released just 2 months ago at the age of 31 and has now published her memoir, Free Cyntoia, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System.
To any young women and girls who find themselves in the situation that I was in, I would say that there are people that hear you. There are people who understand what you're going through. I understand. I've been through it myself. And there were times that I didn't think that I was going to make it. But the Lord brought me through it, and He can bring you through it as well. So just keep faith and keep fighting.
We'll speak with Cyntoia Brown Long in one of her first interviews after prison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Shelling is continuing in northern Syria one day after Turkey agreed to a U.S. plan to halt its assault on Kurdish-controlled areas for 5 days. Turkey invaded the region after President Trump withdrew U.S. support for the Kurds. Vice President Mike Pence announced the deal after meeting with the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara.
The Turkish side will pause Operation Peace Spring in order to allow for the withdrawal of YPG forces from the safe zone for 120 hours. All military operations under Operation Peace Spring will be paused, and Operation Peace Spring will be halted entirely on completion of the withdrawal.
Turkey has refused to call the deal a ceasefire. On Thursday, a Kurdish commander said they would accept the deal, but only along part of the border. The New York Times reports the deal, quote, amounts to a near total victory for Turkey's president, because it would allow Turkey to keep occupying parts of northern Syria. In addition, the U.S. would lift its sanctions on Turkey. It remains unclear what will happen to Kurds who live near the Turkish border. Former Obama official Colin Kahl told The Guardian, quote, if they really think they're going to push the Kurds all the way back to behind the M4 highway, that's a huge population transfer. It would involve massive ethnic cleansing, essentially, he said. Meanwhile, Amnesty International is accusing Turkey of committing war crimes by carrying out summary killings and unlawful attacks that have killed and injured civilians in northern Syria. Kurdish authorities report at least 218 civilians have been killed in the Turkish offensive, including 18 children. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney publicly confirmed Thursday President Trump blocked nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine in an attempt to pressure Kiev to investigate the Democrats. House Democrats say Mulvaney's admission could mark a turning point in the impeachment probe. Mulvaney made the comments while being questioned during a televised press briefing at the White House.
That he also mentioned to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money. Now, there was a report.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy.
Mick Mulvaney went on to continue to defend the administration's actions.
And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
Mick Mulvaney's comments shocked many in Washington for directly undercutting President Trump's claim that there was no quid pro quo with Ukraine. Hours after the news conference ended, Mulvaney accused the media of misconstruing his comments, issuing a statement contradicting his previous remarks. The statement read in part, quote, "Let me be clear, there was absolutely no quid pro quo between Ukrainian military aid and any investigation into the 2016 election," he said. The U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, confirmed to House impeachment investigators that President Trump had delegated Rudy Giuliani, his personal attorney, to be in charge of foreign policy around Ukraine, sidestepping the State Department. Sondland said, quote, "I did not understand until much later that Mr. Giuliani's agenda might have also included an effort to prompt the Ukrainians to investigate Vice President Biden or his son, or to involve Ukrainians directly or indirectly in the president's 2020 re-election campaign," he said. In related news, Energy Secretary Rick Perry has announced he's resigning by the end of the year. He was recently subpoenaed as part of the House impeachment inquiry over his role in Ukraine. The White House has announced the next G7 summit will be held at the Trump National Doral Miami Golf Resort in Florida. The announcement was widely criticized. Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, said, quote, "It's hard to imagine a more blatant violation of the Constitution's anti-corruption provision than the president steering foreign governments to stay at his luxury resort property," unquote. On Thursday, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney dismissed the criticism, claiming the White House had determined the Trump-owned resort was the best possible site in the entire country to host the summit.
We know the environment we live in. You all know the environment that we live in. And he knows exactly that he's going to get these questions and exactly get that reaction from a lot of people. And he's simply saying, okay, that's fine. I'm willing to take that. The same way he takes it when he goes to Trump Mar-a-Lago, the same place when he goes to play Trump Bedminster. He got over that a long time ago. We absolutely believe this is the best place to have it. We're going to have it there. And there's going to be folks who will never get over the fact that it's a Trump property. We get that. But we're still going to go there.
Acting Chief of Staff Mulvaney also revealed one of the world's most pressing issues, the climate crisis, will not be on the agenda at the G7.
As you're looking at the content of what you want to do next year, it's probably going to be hot in Florida in June. Will climate change be one of the issues that you discuss?
Climate change will not be on the agenda.
In news from Afghanistan, civilian casualties have reached a new high. The United Nations reports a record 4,300 civilians were injured or killed in Afghanistan between July and September. These are the highest figures since the UN began counting in 2009. This comes as the U.S. is intensifying its air war. Last month, U.S. Air Force aircraft dropped 948 missiles and bombs, more than in any month in 5 years. British lawmakers are scheduled to vote Saturday on a new Brexit deal reached between British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the European Union. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn said the Labour Party cannot support the Brexit deal.
This is a day when the Prime Minister seems to have made a deal with the European Union, which doesn't give us the complete freedom of movement between Britain and Northern Ireland, because it creates a customs union border down the Irish Sea. And secondly, it does nothing to deal with all the concerns that we've raised during Theresa May's premiership and his about a race to the bottom in rights and protections. And we believe the deal he's proposed is heading Britain in the direction of a deregulated society with a sell-off of national assets to American corporations.
In Chicago, a citywide strike by teachers and school support staff has entered its second day, forcing the closing of the nation's third largest school system. Teachers represented by the Chicago Teachers Union, as well as 7,500 support staff represented by SEIU, launched their strike on Thursday. The New York City Council has approved an $8 billion plan to close Rikers Island by 2026 and build four new jails across New York City. What many are calling a national model for prison reform, New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson backed the closing of Rikers.
Conditions matter. These jails are disgusting. These jails should have been closed years ago. We are doing it today. I will proudly vote yes. Thank you all very, very much.
For decades, human rights activists have protested the violence, abuse, and mismanagement inside Rikers Island and have called for its closure. Yet many activists now oppose the plan to replace Rikers with four new jails. The group No New Jails NYC staged a protest outside City Hall on Thursday. This is Nabil Hussein, a member of the group.
In 2015, the same mayor and a lot of the same city council members voted to increase the NYPD budget by over $100 million to hire 1,300 more cops. Now they want to spend 10, 11, who knows how many billions of dollars building what would be the tallest skyscraper jails in the world. These so-called progressives need to take that money and spend it on what would actually keep New Yorkers safe and keep New Yorkers out of jail. Things like housing, education, healthcare, including mental health care. These are the things that the city should be spending resources on instead of investing billions of dollars in locking up our children, our children's children. They're talking about multi-generational jails that would be here for decades, and we're here to stop them.
In Louisiana, a Cuban asylum seeker has died of apparent suicide while being held in solitary confinement at an ICE detention center. The ACLU of Louisiana condemned the death of Roylan Hernandez Diaz, saying, quote, "We will not stand by while ICE tortures people who are exercising their right to seek asylum in the United States." Meanwhile, the group Freedom for Immigrants is reporting two Cuban asylum seekers detained in New Mexico recently slit their wrists, and at least 19 others are planning on doing so in an act of mass resistance. A general strike has shut down much of Barcelona and the Catalonia region of Spain. This comes after days of street protests by Catalan separatists. On Monday, the Spanish Supreme Court sentenced nine Catalan separatist leaders to up to 13 years in prison over their role in Catalonia's 2017 bid for independence from Spain. Lebanon's witnessing its largest protests in years. Earlier today, demonstrators blocked roads with burning tires and marched in Beirut. On Thursday, the Lebanese government dropped a plan to institute new taxes on calls made through WhatsApp. Protesters have condemned the Lebanese government for failing to tackle the country's economic crisis.
We are all poor and we are asking for jobs, for our rights, electricity, water. We are demanding education. One is begging to teach his son. We want to live in dignity.
Mexican security forces briefly captured one of the sons of El Chapo on Thursday, but then released him after authorities came under attack by heavily armed drug cartels. Ovidio Guzman Lopez, a leader of the powerful Sinaloa cartel, was detained in the city of Culiacan during a routine police check. But then members of his cartel responded by laying siege to the city, overwhelming the police and Mexican National Guard. Fighting raged for hours. At least two people died. The Mexican police eventually withdrew and released Guzman. At least 20 prisoners also escaped during the chaotic day. And the legendary Cuban ballerina Alicia Alonso has died at the age of 98. She was the founder of the internationally renowned National Ballet of Cuba. Despite being partially blind, Alonso became one of the most celebrated dancers in the world. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At the age of 16, she was arrested for killing a man who'd picked her up for sex after she'd been forced into sexual slavery as a child. She was sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder for shooting her rapist. Today, Cyntoia Brown Long joins us to share her experience, what's happened in the 15 years since she was incarcerated, and how she won her release. In an incredible development, Cyntoia was granted clemency in January after former Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam commuted her sentence for murdering 43-year-old Johnny Allen, a state agent who took her to his home for sex in 2004. Cyntoia says Allen was behaving erratically and owned a number of guns, and that she feared for her life when she shot him in the head and made her escape. At the time, she was being sexually trafficked and repeatedly abused and drugged and forced into prostitution by a pimp nicknamed Cutthroat. She was just 16 years old at the time of the shooting, but she was tried as an adult and convicted of first-degree murder and aggravated robbery in 2006 without the possibility for parole until 2055. Juveniles in Tennessee who are sentenced to life in prison must spend at least 51 years behind bars. Santoya's case drew widespread attention on social media under the hashtag #FreeSantoyaBrown. Pop superstar Rihanna wrote, "Something's horribly wrong when the system enables these rapists and the victim is thrown away for life." After her repeated appeals in the case were denied, Santoya spoke at her clemency hearing in January.
"I can't make up for what I did, but they've given me a chance to do so much more. You know, I've been able to help people, which is amazing. Young people, you know, young kids, they listen. And I'm still going to try to help people. I still am. Because it's something that people need to understand. It's something people need to know. There's so many things that I understand now that I didn't know. And there's so many young people that still don't know. And I feel called to share that. And whatever you decide, I respect it. But, I mean, I do pray that you show me mercy and that you give me a second chance. That is my prayer. And I can assure each and every one of you that if you do, like, I won't disappoint you. I'm not going to let you down."
That was Santoya Brown Long speaking in January. She was ultimately granted clemency and released from prison in August. She is now 31 years old. This week, she published a book about her experience. She's doing her first interviews. Her memoir is titled "Free Santoya, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System." Santoya Brown Long, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So you are sentenced to life in prison at the age of 16 years old. If you would go back in time and tell us what happened on the night of August 7th, 2004, what led to, well, everything that has happened now, although there was so much before it.
So on the night of August 7th, I was involved with a man by the name of Cutthroat, as you mentioned, and I was going out, meeting with men, having sex for money. And one of the men that had picked me up was a 43-year-old man, as you said, a real estate agent. And he took me back to his home. Just started acting really, like, strange. I started to feel like I was in a situation that I just couldn't get out of, although I just kind of just wanted to just leave. Felt very uncomfortable. Was showing off his guns, things like that. Things just really escalated, and it came to a point where I shot him. I felt that something was about to happen to me. I left, went back to the room.
Got in his pickup truck.
Right, got in his pickup truck. That was the only way I could go back, and went back to the hotel room that I had shared with Cutthroat. About within 24 hours, the police had come and arrested me. I spoke with them freely. I felt that, you know, I had defended myself, so I didn't have anything to hide. Next thing I know, I'm being charged with criminal homicide. So,
how much can you understand as a, at the time you were 16?
Right. At the time I was 16, I really didn't understand the gravity of the situation that I was in, the situation that led to me being arrested. And then, of course, the entire arrest process, the charging process, I didn't get it. I know whenever the detective had spoken with me before I went into the confession room, you know, he kind of just said, talking to me is going to be the difference between 9 years and 99 years. So choice to me was obvious.
No lawyer with you.
Right. No lawyer, no parent. At the time, I did tell them that I was 19 because that's what Cut had told me to say if the police ever got me. You know, couldn't tell them I was 16. However, they did find out after the fact that I was 16 years old. Still didn't attempt to try to call my parents, try to call a lawyer, anything like that.
Take us back, because you're referring to Cutthroat, a man you've come to see in a very different way than you did as a child.
Right.
Even though what happened that night leads to your sentence of life in prison, I want you to go back in your own life now and tell us about where you were born and what led you to the point you were on that fateful night.
So I was born in Fort Campbell. It's a military base, raised in a military community, very supportive community. My family was very supportive. My mother's a teacher. My father, he's retired military. Had pretty much everything that I needed as a child. But, you know, I would go to school and other kids started pointing out that I was different from my parents. I was different from other people. Didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere. Was kind of treated as an outcast and started to develop behavior problems, attitude problems. The school labeled me as the bad kid. Started finding out that, you know, teachers wanted to just get rid of me. They would put me in ISS for the littlest of things, little smart remarks that just natural for certain kids. Found myself in alternative school around the wrong crowd. You know, alternative schools are pretty much like school's version of prison. You know, it's just somewhere to just toss kids.
In sixth grade, you were tossed out of school.
Right, sixth grade. So started getting in deeper with different things, started skipping school, actually wound up catching my first charge with some of the other kids that I had met at alternative school. Then I entered into the juvenile justice system. So pretty much downhill from the time that I entered alternative school. From juvenile justice system, I started running from state custody, from the facilities that they had placed me in. And I started staying on the streets in Nashville. And I was on the streets in Nashville with the people that I had met from running away whenever I was introduced to Cut.
And explain who Cutthroat was.
So Cutthroat, I had known him just for a few weeks, And I had met him right after I had been raped for the first time. A lot was going on, and I had always wanted acceptance from other people. I had always wanted to be seen as though I belong somewhere. And so it was rather quickly that I found myself just drawn to him. I felt that, you know, he listened to me in ways that no one else listened to me. I really felt in my head that I was in a relationship with this man. And so when it came time for him to say, we need money for this, we need money for a hotel, and this is what you can do, it was like, okay, I'm going to do this because I love this person, and I'm just contributing to the relationship. Completely unhealthy thought patterns that I had developed from actually being on the run, learning unhealthy behaviors, unhealthy understanding of sexual relationships. I really had come to see my body as, you know, a good to be traded for shelter, for food, for money, for the things that I needed to get by. So with all those seeds that were already planted, it was, his work was, you know, was already done.
He drew a gun on you. He strangled you.
So it didn't start out that way, naturally. I don't know many people that would stay in a situation where it starts out that way. Of course, they always start out nice, very charming. And, you know, then it would lead to, he would just snatch me up a little, just shake me up. Guns with lectures. And when I say lectures, I mean like hours on end spent telling me, you know, you're nothing but a slut. No one will ever want you but me. And, you know, in my mind, I was like, this is not true. But you got to think like how that's really just sinking into me. I was already in a low place. And, you know, there was times that, one time he actually had choked me until I passed out. Like, the man could have really killed me. That was actually on the night right before I had met Mr. Allen, the man that I had ended up shooting. I had really come to expect violence from men. And I really think that that played a big role in what happened that night. And it would take years for me to really just unpack everything, to just really process all the trauma that I had really built up.
When did you come to understand you had been placed in the foster care system as an infant?
So I was never placed in the foster care system. I was actually adopted directly from my biological mother. So she had actually asked the family that I was with to take care of me. She was incarcerated. She was in and out of jail. And they adopted me directly from her. So I was never placed in foster care.
And when did they explain that, your parents explain that to you?
So I found that out, I guess I was like five, whenever I had started school. And, you know, I was in the classroom. Your parents bring you to school because it's the first day of class. And as the teacher is talking with my mom and dad, I'm playing with the other kids. And I can remember one of the other little boys, he had asked me, you know, why don't I look like my parents? My mother's dark skin, my father as well. And, you know, I had never really thought about it. I didn't feel any different. Mommy and Poppy, they had never treated me any different. So there was no reason for me to, like, really know that I was different. And one question led to other questions, to a full-blown interrogation from kids. That's just what they do. You know, one answer is never good enough. So I remember getting in the car with my mother after class, and, you know, I asked her, and she explained to me, you know, that I was mixed and that I was adopted, and there was introduced this idea of this mystery woman that I came from, and that kind of just set up this lens for me where I just started feeling like, oh, well, I really don't fit here, do I? And I don't fit here either. And so it was just a seed that had been planted.
Explain the moment when you were in one facility or school and your parents couldn't come to pick you up, so they sent a family friend who had been sexually abusing you.
Well, he hadn't been sexually abusing me. He had made an inappropriate comment. So I was actually, I had come back from court, from the facility. The court didn't tell my parents that I was having court that day. They just brought me up from the detention center, and they were going to release me. Well, my mother, she was at work, and she couldn't just leave. She didn't have a substitute. She called my father. My father had already left. He was driving trucks at the time, and he had called his friend to come pick me up. And this,
how old were you?
I was 12, about to be 13, or maybe I was 13, somewhere in there. I think I was 13, actually, because I think that happened in March. So 13 years old. And he had called this friend to pick me up. This friend, I was previously on a trip with them whenever my parents had gone out of town for their anniversary. And the people that we were with had sent me out to go tell him to come inside, to come into the cabin because dinner was ready. And whenever I went out, he was sitting in his truck with his leg hanging out, door open, and he was on the phone with someone. And whenever I said, hey, it's time to eat, he had spoken to the person on the phone. He was like, yeah, it's my homeboy's daughter. She's one of those girls that's developed in all the right places. And, you know, I have been raised on Lifetime movies, so I knew, like, there were certain trigger words that were just not okay. You know, my mother made sure that I understood that. And so, you know, I slammed the door on his leg. I ran inside, and I told the group that I was with, you know, what had happened. And I'm expecting, like, you know, they're finna go in on this man. Like, this is not okay. But the reaction that I got was he walks in and they just hand him a plate of steak. And everybody just sits and talks normally. And so it was like, wait a minute. You know, I'm always told that I need to tell someone. I need to speak up about things. And I do it and nothing happens. So fast forward all these months later and he comes to court to pick me up. Well, when I tell the woman at court, the clerk, I'm not going with him. I don't feel comfortable leaving with him, being alone with this man. She tells the judge, and the judge says, fine, we'll put you in state custody. And state custody is the worst fear of every kid who's been involved in the juvenile justice system because it's the most severe punishment they can give you. For me, being 13 years old, that meant that they can hold me up until I was 19 years old because it's an indeterminate sentence. And so it's like, wait, like, I'm being punished now? Like, I was going to get to go home, but because I don't feel comfortable around this man and I spoke up about it, now I can't go home? So definitely wasn't healthy. Definitely didn't teach me that, you know, it was a good thing to speak up for myself. It was a good thing to advocate for myself. Taught me the exact opposite.
We're going to break and then come back to our discussion. We're talking to Cyntoia Brown Long. She's a sex trafficking survivor who was sentenced to life in prison. after being convicted of first-degree murder. In January of this year, the former Tennessee governor granted her clemency, and she's just gotten out of prison. This is one of her first post-prison interviews. We'll continue with her, learn what happened at her first trial and then beyond, and how a child gets sentenced as an adult. Stay with us. We've been through the stuff. We've been through it all. We had some close calls, but never would fall. We climbed all the mountains, walked through all. J. Blige. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Santoya Brown, well, now Santoya Brown Long, who is a sex trafficking survivor, sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder for shooting her rapist as a teenager. She had been sexually trafficked and repeatedly abused and drugged. The shooting happened when Santoya was 16 years old, but she was tried as an adult. Santoya was granted clemency by former Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam in January. She was released from prison this past August. She is now 31 years old, out with her memoir, Free Santoya, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System. So let's take it to your arrest within 24 hours after you murdered the man who took you home. You were terrified by him. He was going to give you money for sex. You're a teenager. He's showing you his guns. You shoot him. You leave. The police get you. You have no lawyer. And talk about what happened in your hearing. Explain what a transfer hearing is. And then ultimately what happened in your trial, how you ended up with life in prison.
So shortly after my arrest, I was assigned a public defender. And that public defender was part of the juvenile court. So it was her job to prepare my case for a transfer hearing because the district attorney had actually asked the court to try me as an adult. And so what they do is they actually, number one, they find if there's probable cause to believe that you actually committed the offense. And then the second part of the hearing is determining whether there are actually resources within the juvenile justice system that they can use to treat you. Because the goal of the juvenile justice system is supposed to be to remove the taint of criminality. Their focus is supposed to be rehabilitating any individual that comes into the court. So at the transfer hearing, I testified. I was still transferred. I was tried as an adult. They figured that there was just not enough time left within the juvenile court jurisdiction, which was 3 years, 2.5 years, for them to help me. So I go to the adult jail, to the county jail, house in a cell by myself, solitary confinement, to be kept away from the adults.
How long are you in solitary confinement?
2 years. So from the time I was 16 until I turned 18, I was in solitary confinement.
What was that experience like? What does it mean to be in solitary confinement? How large was your cell? Who were you allowed to see?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible. You know, the cell is about the size of probably your bathroom at your house. And you don't get out much. You get out for an hour a day, if they remember you, where you can go outside to be locked in a kennel. Which pretty much a dog kennel. It's a cage, a fenced in cage. And then they'll take you to the shower. And, you know, it was really hard, especially with everything that I was dealing with, because you had like nothing to distract you. You had nothing but everything that you were facing, all of the anxiety, all of the thoughts, all of the trauma, everything that you're trying to deal with is just there in that room with you. And
this is before the trial?
This is before the trial. This is
solitary confinement. You're a teenager for 2 years.
For 2 years, yes. For 2 years. Because every juvenile at that time had to be in solitary confinement. That's just how they did. I mean, they didn't have to be. There was, you know, juvenile facilities that could have housed them until they were 18, but that's just what they felt, I guess, was more convenient for them. So house in solitary confinement as a juvenile, spend all that time, mental health constantly, just feeding you different medications, because when you're telling them, you know, I'm feeling this, I'm experiencing this, they just find another pill. You know, they just kind of use you as a guinea pig.
So you're drugged through this time in a different way than when you were on the streets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The entire time. So finally make it to trial, and I was convicted. I was convicted on all counts.
Did you testify in your trial?
I did not. I had wanted to testify, but my attorneys had advised me against it because they felt that my earlier statement in juvenile court could have been used to impeach me because it was different from when I was telling the police that Cut had nothing to do with anything. I didn't even know him. I had just met him. So they said that by me having testified the way I did in the juvenile court, they could have used that to impeach me. You know, come to find out later that they never could have used that to impeach me anyway, because anything said at the juvenile transfer hearing can't be used against you in later proceedings. So my attorneys were mistaken, you know, with that.
A rather major mistake to have made. And also talk about how your view of cutthroat changed, how you came to understand what sex trafficking was.
So my view of Cut himself, like that took time to change, because whenever I was first incarcerated, I was still thinking, like, this is my boyfriend. I know what my attorney is telling me, that he's making statements against me to the police, but I don't believe him because he told me not to believe it. He told me ahead of time that they would tell me these things. And, you know, I was just so loyal, but I mean, he didn't deserve it at all. But I was just so loyal to him, and it took for them to actually sit down with me. One of the women who actually worked in the juvenile court office, the defender's office, had told me, you know, you're facing life. And I'm like, wait, what do you mean I'm facing life? Like, I didn't even know that was a possibility for me at the age of 16. And so my other attorney had sat down with me, and she took a piece of paper, and she divided it into four sections. And she was like, let's really think this through. And she titled the sections, Things Cut Does That Make Me Feel Good, Things Cut Does That Make Me Feel Bad, Good Things About Cut, Bad Things About Cut. And, you know, I got to see, putting it on that paper, that, you know, the bad far outweighed the good.
This is the man who held guns to you, who strangled you.
Right, right. So actually getting to see, like, that forced me to, like, really rethink things. And it's like, this isn't what I thought it was. And, you know, they let me know, like, it's important for you to tell the court everything. Like, you're facing serious charges here. You're facing life in prison. And so, you know, when I went to the juvenile court, I was like, I'm going to have to tell them everything. And I did at the transfer hearing.
At the transfer hearing. But yeah. When it came to your trial, they said you could not speak.
Right. When it came to the trial, they advised me not to testify. I wanted to testify. My family wanted me to testify, but they said that it wouldn't be in my best interest, and so I didn't. They never got to hear my side of the story.
Talk about the day you were convicted. Describe where you were in court, what happened, and when you were sentenced to life in prison.
So the day that I was convicted, this was, I believe it was the fifth day of trial, and
you'd never spoken.
I had never spoken, just sat there in the courtroom, showing up every day, just listening. And, you know, you're listening to everybody just talk about the worst thing that you've ever done and paint you in the worst possible light. It's brutal. It's really brutal. And you can't even speak up for yourself. Like, you're having to depend on other people to speak up for you, but there's never going to be anyone that advocates for you the way that you can. And so it's really difficult. And at the conclusion of the trial, the jury goes for deliberation. I sat in the holding cell for a while.
Had they brought up your age in trial?
They did. They brought up my age. You know, my attorneys had brought up the fact that I was with this man that was abusing me. They had brought up the fact that, you know, there was actual photo evidence where this man was taking nude pictures of me. And I can remember, you know, when my attorney had taken the picture, it was folded up. He didn't show me nude, but he just showed the look on my face, just how miserable I was, just how blank I was to the jury. And the district attorney comes back.
They show a nude picture of you at trial?
Right. My attorney didn't show the nude part. He had blocked it off. It was folded in half. However, the DA actually came and unfolded and was like, well, this is the rest of the picture. And I was like, what was that about? My attorneys and I were like, we were all shocked, you know? So it was just, that is just one moment that just indicates how it was just like one big just assault on everything that I felt about myself. Like, it just made me feel horrible. It made me feel like a horrible human being. It made me feel, you know, this was my fault. Like, what happened with me with Cut? Like, I didn't ask for him to do those things to me, but I was made to feel that I did ask for it.
So you're in a holding area, and then you're brought in for the verdict.
So I'm in the holding area, and they tell me, actually, that because it was taking so long, it was getting so late, they actually thought that deliberations would pick up that Monday. So I'm thinking, okay, this is good, because they say the longer they deliberate, the better it is. Like, this is good. Like, surely I'll get 15 years for second-degree murder, worst-case scenario. Like, surely they won't find me guilty of first degree. Like, it's just... It's not what happened. You know, you keep thinking, like, I know what happened. Like, that's not what happened. Surely they won't find that. And so my mother had left because, you know, they told her they won't come back with, you know, a verdict today. And so my mother had left, and I'm there by myself with my attorneys. When they call, they say, oh, they came up with a verdict. And I was like, they did? And we go up there, they bring the jury in, and I'm just looking at them, just desperate to get any kind of indication of what happened. And I remember there was one man, it was a black man, and during jury questioning, they had asked him if he had any experience with the justice system, any kind of thing, you know, that would make him, you know, biased. And he had said that he had a nephew that was actually involved in the system. And so I'm thinking, okay, he's going to fight for me. Like, because he understands. But whenever he came in, like, he looked at me and he just hung his head and shook his head. And I was like, that's not good. And it's like I knew then, you know. And I looked at every single one of their faces, like, and they wouldn't look at me. They wouldn't look at me. And I was like, this is not good. And so whenever they read the verdict, it was like, like, you could just feel it. It's like it just stabbed you in the heart, like, each word. And, I mean, it was rough. And then right after that, the judge says, you know, it's an automatic life sentence. And you're just stuck there, like, what just happened, you know?
So it's automatic life sentence. Mm-hmm. You were sentenced that day to life in prison.
Life in prison in the state of Tennessee. Anytime you're convicted of first-degree murder, it's automatic life sentence. It doesn't matter if you're a juvenile. No consideration is given to any mitigating factors. There's absolutely no way around that. It's automatic life sentence. Mandatory.
So let's talk about what happened to you then in prison. You're in adult prison. You're 16 years old. You face life in prison. You have to serve over half a century of mm-hmm. that. Talk about your feelings of, I guess you could say, redemption. I mean, the subtitle of Free Santoyo, your memoir, is My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System. Talk about the educational system in the prison and who you came to meet.
So my entire life, I could remember always feeling like I was thrown away, like I wasn't worth salvaging, you know, and of course, the entire court process, it just reinforced that belief. So naturally, like, the way I felt about myself, like, it was just at an all-time low. And there was a program, a volunteer program from a local university, Lipscomb University in Nashville, that had come and they offered college courses free of charge for people housed at Tennessee Prison for Women. And took some time, took some work, and I finally got into the program. And once I get into this program, you know, I start thinking, like, wow, like, I can actually do these things. I'm actually smart. Like, you start to think about, you know, these people are actually listening to what I'm saying, and they think I'm smart, and They don't think that, you know, I'm some dumb girl who made all these dumb choices. They see me as so much more than that. They don't even look at the worst thing that I've done. Like, they don't even acknowledge that. They worry about who I am now, and they see me for me. And I can't tell you just how redeeming that is. And it just made me, it made me want to do better. It made me want to live. It made me want to strive. And it was just an incredible experience. And it just, like, really just set me on a path. Didn't take me all the way there. You know, I wouldn't come all the way to feeling that, you know, I was fully walking in my redemption until I developed a relationship with Jesus. And, you know, I talk all about that in the book and, like, what an important, important part that played in my life and in my freedom.
So. You also talk about a mentor you had when you were in prison. How did you meet her?
Are you talking about Mrs. Seabrooks?
Yes.
So I met Mrs. Seabrooks when I was trying to get into the Lipscomb program. She's actually, well, she was. She's retired now, which is unfortunate because she was awesome. She was the principal of the education department, and she had given me a chance, and she really worked with me because there were so many people trying to get into the program, but she had seen from placement testing that I had potential. And even though I was on close security, which was a higher security designation because I had gotten in trouble, she worked with me, and she gave me the chance to interview, to take the test, and then the day I got off of close security, she allowed me to enter the program.
And when you learned what happened to Cut in prison, what happened to him?
So I actually learned that prior to my trial. 8 months after I was incarcerated, at the end of March 2005, he was actually killed by another man in a parking lot.
Did that change your view of having to defend him?
No, like, I had already, before that, before he had died, I had already come forward with everything, with the truth. You know, I had told him at the transfer hearing, which was in November of 2004. It didn't change anything, even though the detectives had found that information out. They still didn't follow up on anything, but I thought that I had come to a point where, you know, I was over it. I understood things, but I remember, like, when I found out he died, like, it brought up those old feelings, and I was devastated. I remember just screaming when I found out.
When you were, when you went to school and you started to really talk and think through things, you started to come to understand the situation you were in, the whole idea of sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. You had appealed your sentence, and you had appealed, entered an appeal in your case. Talk about when it was denied, where you were, and why it is you never gave up hope.
So I actually lost not just one appeal, but three appeals. My first appeal, my direct appeal, was denied around 2009. Then I filed a post-conviction appeal that was denied as well. And my final appeal that was due to me was the federal habeas corpus. And that was denied, and it was said that I couldn't even appeal that. And so you keep trying and you keep hoping that some court is going to give me some kind of leniency. They're going to show me some kind of compassion. They're going to see all these things, but it never happens.
So we have to break. But when we come back, I want to ask you about the remarkable story of your professor at Lipscomb, who was the assistant attorney general. You did not realize at the time who had denied your appeal and the conversation that you had. We'll be back in a minute with Santoya Brown Long, a sex trafficking survivor who just got out of prison. Her sentence, she was granted clemency by the former Tennessee governor. She had been sentenced to life in prison at 16. Stay with us.
Morning starts with a pill, and it'll reach its peak. All the women I meet are tired. They just kick up their feet prior to my sitting dog. Sitting dog, yeah. I belong to no one. You tried hard to be mine.
Every Woman by Vagabond. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, spending the hour with Santoya Brown-Long, a sex trafficking survivor sentenced to life in prison at the age of 16. She would be granted clemency last January by the former Tennessee governor. Santoya, you're in prison. Your appeal is denied, but you're going to school, Lipscomb University, within the prison, a program that absolutely saved your life. And when is...
Saved my life, but it helped.
When do you realize that Preston Shipp, your professor at Lipscomb, was the assistant attorney general who denied your first appeal?
So it was at the end of the semester. My appeal had actually came down. It was denied. That was on a Thursday that I got my appeal. And the Wednesday night before that, I had class with him, and he was acting really weird, really concerned, and asked me, was I okay? And I said, yeah. And I didn't even know why he was asking me that way. And so the next day, I got my appeal as denied. Didn't really look through it that day. Actually went to a Lipscomb function that night for their literary journal, looking for him for help with the appeal, because I hadn't read it to even see, but he didn't even show up that night. He wasn't there. And so that next day, when I went to the law library, my friend Erica East had helped me, you know, to really stop, slow down, let's read it and figure out where we go from here. And the first few lines, they actually list the parties involved in the appeal, lists me, my attorney's names, then it lists the prosecutors. And they're was Preston's name. And it was like, what? Because the thing is, you see your DA at trial, but when it comes to the appellate court, that's an entirely different office. That's the attorney general's office. You never see them because you don't actually go to the appellate courts to attend those hearings. So I wouldn't have recognized him because I've never seen him. And for him, he didn't recognize it either. It's very hard, you know, to remember a name in a case. And I think that's a big problem with the system now. We're just reduced to case numbers and names on a file. But he didn't realize it either. But whenever he put it together, I mean, he was devastated. He felt horrible.
So you talk with him about your case. He's the one who denied the appeal.
Well, he didn't deny the appeal. The judge denied the appeal. But he fought for that. He fought.
And what did he say he understood in speaking to you that he hadn't understood when he looked at your case?
Well, he told me, like, how he didn't understand everything else that had happened. He didn't know anything about cut. He didn't know anything about everything surrounding just that one moment. And, you know, he spoke to me about how him as a prosecutor, how he saw that that was an issue. Because as a prosecutor, you're just given these certain facts and you just stand on those facts. You don't listen to anything else.
You were granted clemency by the former Texas governor, but it didn't happen out of the blue. Talk about the campaign that went viral for your release. I mean, the title of your book is Free Santoya.
Mm-hmm. So, former Tennessee governor Bill Haslam granted me clemency January 2019, and I remember filing, I believe it was December 2017, for clemency. And we had been working with his office. We had been working with some other strategists to prepare a clemency petition for me prior to that. And about a few weeks before we were going to file, a news story had run about me filing for clemency. And overnight, it blew up. It spread like wildfire. And it's really nothing short of a miracle, you know, from God, the way that so many people around the world were just rallying for me to be freed. And took a year and 1 month from the time that I filed the petition for Governor Haslam to grant me clemency on the basis of all the changes that I had made, the work that I'd done with Lipscomb.
So superstar Rihanna, for example, wrote, "Something is horribly wrong when the system enables these rapists and the victim is thrown away for life." Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you?
I mean, it just, I mean, that validates everything that I know. Like, there is something wrong when you throw away anybody, when you see people as disposable, when you don't see that, you know, this person is just as capable of being redeemed as anyone else.
I want to turn to the statement by then-Governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam, who granted you clemency. He said a life sentence without the possibility of parole until you're in your 60s was, quote, too harsh, especially in light of the extraordinary steps Ms. Brown has taken to rebuild her life. He added, quote, transformation should be accompanied by hope. Did you get to meet Governor Haslam?
I did. And he is just an incredible man, just such a strong man of God, just very humble, very kind, you know, very intelligent. Just, it was really nice to meet him.
Centoya, you got married in prison.
I did.
Talk about what happened. How did you meet Jay?
When I tell you God brought me the perfect man, just even the way that we met, which, you know, I detail it further in the book, the way that we met is just, you know, it's just full of God. You can just see his hand all in it. For about 3 years, it'll be 3 years in January from the time that we actually met. We started communicating, and we'll be married in a year come January.
He wrote you a letter?
He did.
In prison?
He wrote to me. We started writing back and forth, started spending hours on the phone. He would visit me in prison, and was just really there for me, was the person that helped me get through, like, some of those really, really hard moments. Like, he was there, and just... He's my best friend. I love him.
And he's standing right outside this door right now.
He is. He's always with me everywhere I go.
Finally, as we just have a minute to go, the other Centoyas that are out there, of course, you are unique, but what you left behind and the people you left behind and what you're doing now about them.
So I just... Whenever everyone was speaking up for me, like, you know, it gave me hope that, okay, we're seen. Like, somebody sees us, because you always feel that your voice doesn't matter, which, you know, that shouldn't be how it is. And their voice, their situation, their lives are just as valuable as mine. And I feel that God has given me this opportunity to just really use this platform in a way that sheds light on them as well. Like, there are so many other people like me. There are so many women, so many men who are facing injustice.
I saw you nodding your head as I was presenting headlines about Rikers being shut down.
Yeah.
And those who are saying it's not about other jails being built.
No.
The money has to go into education, has to go into programs for people who are imprisoned, particularly youth.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, the first response is to just lock people up and throw them away when, you know, if you really just take the time to invest in people, like, people aren't disposable. Like, we're all capable of redemption. We're all capable of being helped and being our better selves. Like, everyone deserves a second chance.
On that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Centoya Brown Long, sex trafficking survivor, sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder for shooting her rapist as a teenager. A years-long campaign helped her to win her freedom. She was granted clemency in January, released in August. Her memoir, Free Centoya, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System. It was published this week. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.